Welcome to the Six Figure Developer Podcast, the podcast where we talk about new and exciting technologies, professional development, clean code, career advancement, and more. I'm John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.
With us today is Mike Cohn. For over 20 years, Mike has been building high-performing software development teams and organizations through the use of Agile and Scrum. He's worked with startups and some of the largest organizations in the world. Welcome, Mike.
Thanks, Clayton. It's nice to be here.
Before we kind of jump into the meat of things, would you just kind of give us a little bit of background about yourself, kind of maybe how you got started in the industry? And
sure. I think I had a pretty typical progression. Started out as a programmer. I got into that as a PhD student in economics and dropped out what's called all but dissertation when I saw how much you make with a PhD. It was a lot less than you made with a master's. So I quit with my master's and went places working and doing economics research. And everywhere I went back then, they needed more programming help than they needed one more economist. So just kind of stuck with that. And it's what I love doing anyway. So started out that way as a programmer, worked my way up to managing teams, a director in different organizations, VP, CTO type things. So a fairly typical programmer to management progression, I believe.
Very nice. So how did you get involved in the whole Agile movement?
I knew Ward Cunningham, who was one of the guys at the Agile Manifesto meeting. He emailed me the day after the meeting. I just worked with on a project here in Boulder, Colorado. He emailed me the next day and said, "Hey, look what I did over the weekend." And that was the Agile Manifesto. So I got involved with that and through that met Mary Poppendick. And Mary and I were the two that kind of co-founded the Agile Alliance, just kind of get it going, just to get the paperwork, and then brought a whole bunch of other people like Bob Martin and stuff and right at the beginning. But so I was right there right afterwards through the relationship with Ward.
So with the formation of the Agile Alliance and things like that, and I know you've authored a number of books, many of which I've got on the shelf behind me. Has it been just well received and the community responding well right out of the gate? How much of a transition from the old software development practices, many of which were waterfall types of development, how easy is that transition, or has that transition been for the companies that you've worked with or been involved with?
Well, I think a lot of us were doing Agile before the name came around. The name got assigned in 2001, and I'd been doing Scrum since 95 when it really first got started. But back in the late 90s, if you were doing what's called Agile today, you really felt alone. Everybody was doing what was called the Rational Unified or the Unified process back then, and the company in particular that I worked for, we were buying not a lot, but maybe a handful of companies a year, and every time we bought one, they were doing the unified process, and they'd have all this wonderful documentation that's great to artifacts. And we'd buy them, and I'd constantly be like, "Oh man, maybe we need the time to do these documents. You know, look at how much better they were. They had all these nice documents." And after doing that for a couple of years, seven or eight companies like that, it was like, "Okay, there's a reason we're buying them. They're not buying us." And I was just very thankful that we'd always been too busy to do those documents. I remember one company we bought, just talking to their VP, and they had all the documents were put into slip sheets, like the little like plastic sheets that would keep the paper nice. And I just remember being like, "Wow, this looked really nice." And I said to like, "What do you do when the document changes, right? You know, what a pain. You got to take it all out of these slip cases." It's like, "Well, we just don't change the documents, right? You know, we don't want to have to do that. So we don't change the documents." Like, okay, this is wrong, right? You don't want to change the documents because of your sheet protectors. And so back in the 90s, you felt very alone doing this. And that was what was nice when the manifesto came out in 01. People kind of came out of the woodwork saying, "Me too, me too." And all of a sudden, you had this rallying point and you could rally around the term Agile and say, "Yeah, that's what I do." And it was nice because you didn't have that feeling of being alone. And in the 90s, as much as success as the company I was with was having, you still had your doubts, right? It was just like, okay, are we the only ones doing this? And so I think the adoption was either people loved it or they hated it, because there was a lot of doubt at the beginning that this could possibly be a good way to build software.
So you said that you were doing Scrum in 1995, which is way before the Agile Manifesto. How has Scrum changed since then, or is it basically the same?
Oh, it's changed quite a bit. Some of the early stuff in Scrum is no longer there. I mean, Scrum initially, then Jeff Sutherland and Ken Schwaber wrote about it. I mean, there were phases to it. There was the reason it was somewhat called Scrum is there was a pre-game, a game, and a post-game, which were basically like inception and wrap-up phases around the process. Initially, there was something called sync steps. There were gaps between sprints in some of the early writings. I didn't necessarily do all those things. I did a little bit. We had read about Scrum before I came across Jeff's stuff and read about it in a book that had come out in 1990 and kind of mixed it with stuff that was from Barry Beam's Spiral model. And so we kind of were going through spirals combined with Scrum and doing it without the gaps and some of the other things there. But the early definitions of Scrum are very, very different than what we saw at the beginning.
Okay. And then, so one of the reasons why companies might be most familiar with you is the Scrum Master courses that Mountain Goat Software does. You want to explain what that is and maybe go into a little bit more detail?
Well, the Scrum Master course is, it was started by the Scrum Alliance, and Ken Schwaber and I taught the first one of those in 2003. He came up with the idea because he was... He'd been in a company back then, would have been late 2002, and he said they want to buy Scrum, they want to own Scrum. And he said, I told him it's open source, just do it. They don't need to buy it, they don't need to own it. But 2002 is back when everybody was afraid of open source, right? You didn't want to use open source in case it turned out somebody owned the copyright and they owned four lines of your website, now you're out of business. And so he had to come up with a way of basically of selling somebody something. And so he came up with the Certified Scrum Master course, and we were doing that through the Scrum Alliance, which we'd co-founded. And so it's really just a way to get people to master Scrum. And that's really the wrong way to think about it. You don't master Scrum in a couple of days, but more to be the Scrum Master, which is more like a master of ceremonies. There's somebody who can coordinate the Scrum teams, work them through the process, things like that. So that's what the course is about. And there have been a lot of people who've gone through that course in the last 15 years.
I was wondering if it has changed much through the last 15 years.
Yes and no. I mean, if you looked at it, I mean, I think, no matter anybody who's taught it, they've learned new ways to teach, right? So I end every class with just a pocket of notes. I mean, I'll leave every class with 3 to 10 notes. I just write them during breaks or when they're doing exercise, when attendees doing exercise, I just shove them in my back pocket. I go upstairs every class with 5 to 10 notes that I have to change. I mean, they're not necessarily big changes each time, but, tweak this. I didn't explain this well, or people had a lot of questions about this. Let's add a slide about it or an exercise. So I think there's been a lot of that. But if you look at the core of Scrum, Scrum's a pretty darn simple framework. There have been some I think pretty successful attempts in the past of, every now and then somebody gets a wild hair and says, let's see if we can describe Scrum in 100 words. And it's not even really hard, right? I mean, 100 words, you can describe it. So you go to the fundamentals, that hasn't really changed. But, back in the very beginnings of Scrum, and even in the 2000s, the retrospective was not a part of Scrum. And that's very fundamental to Scrum these days, but it wasn't there at the beginning. So.
Yeah, and it seems like there's a lot of misunderstanding, maybe misinformation, maybe just the failure on the community's part or the developer's part or the team's part to communicate the ideas of Agile and Scrum through the rest of the business or the business to communicate it with their clients. I've often heard, oh, we don't do Agile, we do Scrum, or we don't do Scrum, we do Agile. And I'm like, okay. Where does that misunderstanding come from, or how can we more clearly articulate the types of things we're attempting to do? Is it more about talking about the value we're trying to deliver as opposed to the ceremonies that we must participate in?
I think you're right, John. It's I want the terms to go away, right? I mean, I just don't want to talk about Agile and Scrum. you know, you don't, I don't mean like today with you guys, right? But as an industry, it's like, I don't want to talk. I'm done. I'm out of here. So what I mean is that, you know, you don't walk around the office anymore and hear anybody say, oh, it's 2 o'clock. I have to get to the object-oriented design meeting, right? You know, object-oriented is a good way to design. I mean, there's other approaches too, but, you know, back when objects took over versus like structured programming, it won and we stopped talking about it. It was just what we did. And I want so much of Agile and Scrum to be just what we do. And we don't have to talk about a daily Scrum, right? I mean, teams, of course they talk once a day and, you know, and if they don't, it's not a big deal because they talked the last 83 days in a row, right? So who cares? But until we get that stuff to be fundamental, it's just like how we do things, we end up still talking about it. But, you know, I've for 10 years hoped it goes away. And again, it goes away in the sense that it just becomes what we do, not it, you know, gets replaced by, oh, let's go back to, you know, big waterfall projects or something, but it just becomes adopted. We have to stop obsessing over, am I doing Scrum or am I doing Agile? And what's the relationship between the two, which for some reason people still struggle with quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah. There's still a lot of struggle with a number of different companies out there that just, you know, they don't really know what it is they're supposed to be doing in trying to deliver a valuable product. They've heard about Agile, they've heard about Scrum. There's a Dilbert comic that I'll read here that I really enjoy. We're going to try something called Agile programming. That means no more planning and no more documentation. Just start writing code and complaining. The last frame says, I'm glad it has a name. That was your training.
Yeah, that's pretty sad. I think a lot of that comes from people getting really confused between the practices that an Agile team exhibits and the principles that underlie those practices. Why are we doing something versus what are the external stuff? And I just, you know, it is just sad because I remember debating this with people back in probably 2003 at some of the early Agile conferences. And it was really, I mean, we talked about it back then as a Karate Kid conversation, right? You know, if you wax on all day, do you learn the Agile principles, right? And so if you've got a team doing short iterations, they're putting out software every couple of weeks, they're pair-programming, they're testing like crazy, they don't know why they're doing those things, but is that team Agile, right? And, you know, that was a debate 15 years ago. And we're still arguing a little bit about, you know, do you have to start with the principles or the practices? And I don't know that I really have an opinion which you have to start with, but you better quickly get to understanding the principles or you're not going to be making the right decisions. And I think as the whole thing is spread and, you know, there's a lot of money to be made, you know, anytime something gets popular, consultants want to do it. And, you know, they'll come in and they'll see there's money to be made teaching people this and they'll come in and they don't understand the principles themselves. So.
Yeah, I would say just go back and reread the Agile Manifesto.
I reread it today. So I read a book about it today and I reread it today. So yes. So
What book, out of curiosity?
It's a book by Scott Duncan. It's I think it's on InfoQ right now and he's coming out with like a new edition of it. So I was looking at that. So I think it's called Understanding Agile Principles.
Yeah, I find that businesses all too often, And some of it's the developers' fault because we push for things. We want things to be better. And so we push for Agile or we push for Scrum. And then the company goes, okay, fine, we'll do that. But they don't understand why the developers are asking for it, or they look at it as just a set of things to do. And so they just do that. And it usually ends up with not actually fixing anything and sometimes making things worse.
That's a perfect way to describe it, a set of things to do, right? Which is, you know, not what we want to have people believe. It needs to be a set of principles that, you know, underlie your behavior, not a set of things to do. So, but set of things to do is easy, right? So that's what people fall back to.
Yeah, exactly. Is there, in your experience, is there anything that, like say a developer could do that would try to push up the chain the importance of why we're trying to do something?
No matter how, a lot of good Agile transformation start at the bottom, and then, you know, move bottom up from teams to middle management, and then hopefully up there. But there's always a level that the transformation hits where unless you get support from above, it's going to get squelched. And so, you know, there's always going to be some level of middle management that looks at it and is just kind of threatened by it. It's like, I have to give up my corner office, or I don't get to tell you what to do every day or something. They, you know, they lose some authority. And well, you know, I mean, I get it, but a lot of managers look at that and think that's a bad thing. And, you know, sometimes people want to, you know, we're going to change to Agile. Let's use this as an excuse to throw out everything that I don't like. And so, you know, they'll, well, let's get rid of all planning, or let's get rid of all management. We don't need any management. I saw a podcast today that was like, fire all the managers. And it was literally like saying every manager in the world should be fired. It's like, yeah, I don't think so, right? Maybe we someday we get to a world where we don't need people coordinating work, but we're not there in 2019. It's just not where the world's at. It's just too many people don't, you know, haven't come up in the workplace that way. So I think one of the things that a development team is going to have to do is sell the benefits of it to those that are kind of at least two or three levels above there. So whatever they can do to start promoting those things. And I just think there's so many benefits to working in an agile manner. I mean, you know, we can look at higher quality. We can look at faster development time. We can look at products that are more likely to delight customers, but we can go all the way to happier teams, right? And I mean, that's a benefit on its own, right? Job satisfaction of your employees, you're likely to get benefits just from that. So I think it's a matter of selling some of those benefits to people a couple of levels up.
So have you found have you found issues? Because I guess what kind of speaking out of some of my experiences, there's been times where you're kind of pushing those benefits, but the buy-in that you get isn't good enough to actually make the implementation show those benefits. And so like, it's sort of like the hard sell in the long run, because people haven't, you know, fully bought in to what those benefits are. How have you dealt with that sort of situation?
Well, I mean, sometimes it is you're right. It is sometimes a long-term sell, right? You're not going to walk up to somebody who's probably been very successful with a more waterfallish manner and convince them that everything they've done in their career has been wrong, right? So it has to be a bit of a long-term sell. And if you've got a manager that's been successful with another approach, you can't discount that, right? And it may very well have been the right way to do things over the last 10 or 20 years, but you know, the world is getting faster, and the way companies compete these days is by cycling through ideas. And so time has to be a competitive advantage. You can't just be, you know, coming up with the idea. That's not going to win. And so the faster that somebody can build something, that's how they're going to compete. And so you sell it over the long term. When I run into resistance, I tend to look at why somebody's resisting, and then attack that, because it could be, normally it's one of three things: an awareness, desire, or an inability. And so you look at, is the person aware that Agile is better? And if not, you want to educate them about why Agile is better. If they're aware, do they have the desire to actually make a change? And some people are very aware, but just don't really want to make a change. It's like, now is not a good time, or let's do it after this project. And those are 100% valid excuses, right? I shouldn't even say excuse. Excuse sounds negative. Those are valid reasons to not do something, right? We're finishing up a major project. I don't want to switch process either, right? But then you have to, you know, find a way to increase the urgency. So if a lack of desire is the thing, increase the urgency. And then the last one is somebody have the ability to actually make the transition? And if they don't have the ability, that's where getting some training or bringing in on-site coaching, something like that, is going to help. Just to help that all make sense, I'll give a personal example that has nothing to do with software. But my mom was great. My mom died a few years back, but she was great. Loved my mom. Awesome. But she was the world's worst cook, just absolutely horrible cook. And her way of cooking vegetables would be boil a vegetable for 6 hours or something. Right. And it was bad. And so I grew up not liking most vegetables, and I still don't eat enough vegetables. And so, you know, if I go to dinner and there's like, oh, burger or salad, as I'm going for the burger, right? And so I have an awareness that I should eat more vegetables in my diet. I don't really have a desire yet to do it, but if I went to a doctor and the doctor said, Mike, lay off the burgers, you're going to die in 6 months, right? That would increase the urgency, right? So now I'd have the desire. Now, I don't have the ability to actually cook the burger, right? Because all I know how to do is boil vegetables for 6 hours. That's all I saw being done. So now I got to go. So you're laughing at me, John. Now I got to get the ability, right? I got to, you know, I got to get some recipes or something like that, so I know how to actually cook the things. And so that to me would be an example of that awareness, desire, ability cycle. And so if I'm facing resistance, I want to know why somebody's resisting. It's normally one of those three things.
All right. And we've mentioned agile transformations a number of times. And the thing that comes to mind there is, you know, switching from a long drawn out waterfall type process of, you know, a year or more to deliver something into more of a fast iterative development and release cycle. How would you go about having those conversations with companies, clients, businesses that, you know, we're going to start defining a minimum viable product and delivering smaller things? I started to have this conversation with a colleague of mine, and he held up his McDonald's drink cup from lunch that day and said, you know, if a client came to me and said, I need this cup made, I couldn't deliver a straw in 2 weeks and say, that's your first delivery, because that doesn't fulfill any particular need. But I think that also kind of points to that conversation that we need to better define those minimum viable products and have those conversations.
You know, I don't know. I'd question that example. You know, I like that you brought up the McDonald's and the straw example, but if, I mean, examples can be silly when products exist, but right, if somebody said, you know, we need to create an experience where people can enjoy beverages in our restaurant and on the go, somebody invented the straw. I don't know, some caveman or whatever, but somebody invented the straw. And I think we're seeing places deal with this right now. I was out to dinner with my family last night, and they brought drinks to our table. We ordered drinks, whatever, and they, you know, they didn't bring any straws. And my wife had a margarita that she wanted a straw in, and so they brought her two little kind of cocktail straws, little tiny ones, not the like big normal straws. And it's like, you know, this whole thing where straws are killing sea turtles. It's like, well, why aren't the little cocktail straws killing sea turtles too? Why will you, you know, you don't bring my daughter a straw for her soda, but you bring two in the margarita, right? And my other daughter mentioned that, I think it was like Starbucks or something, is figuring out ways to embed a straw into the cup or something so you can drink it out of like the lid. And so I would think that would be part of an incremental innovation. If somebody said, figure out how we're going to do this, I do think coming back in 2 weeks and going, hey, we invented the thing that replaces the straw, right? And now that doesn't work with the traditional cup, so we've invented a new type of cup. And then 2 weeks later, you come back with a beverage. One of the examples I use in some of my my video training is of making a pizza, right? We want to make a pizza. And, you know, in the first iteration, we might come up with the best sauce for the pizza. The next round, we might try sausage from 8 different vendors and pick the sausage that best goes with the sauce and isn't, you know, $100 a pound or something, right? So that to me would be iterative. And I think a lot of other businesses know that, right? They do think about it that way. Sometimes in software, we get caught up and we have to design the whole thing. And to me, that comes from companies just asking the fundamentally wrong question. Companies always ask, what should we build? And it's the wrong question. The question is, what should we build next, right? What should you build next and then go?
Yeah, that's why I like that story in particular, because my colleague held up the cup and immediately said, we can't deliver a straw. And your first instinct was, what they need is a beverage delivery function, you know, a way to deliver the beverage. And I think too often developers and software creators take the initial request from the business, from a client, and say, oh, you need this cup. I will set out to build that cup for you. Instead of asking those questions, what is it you're trying, what is the need you're trying to fill? What is the problem you're trying to solve?
Absolutely. And my view of that is that, you know, we have a customer, and the customer has a problem. The customer is not uniquely qualified to know the solution to that problem, right? Just because you have the problem doesn't mean you know the answer, right? I mean, I have a problem. I like straws. I drink a lot of iced tea. I like straws. I care for sea turtles, but I like straws. What am I going to do? And so I, you know, some of the restaurants I go to these days, I just don't order a drink because I know I'm not going to enjoy it without a straw. So restaurants have a problem. You know, they're losing, I don't know, $3-4 every time I don't buy a drink, right? That would impact a restaurant, right? That's a problem we're solving for them. So it is a matter of framing the problem. I've been reading a lot of marketing stuff just over the last couple of years because, you know, small business, I have to have stuff to sell, but I, you know, so I have to know what I'm doing, but I got to market it too, right? And so one of the things that comes up a lot in the marketing books is a famous example of nobody wants to buy a drill, right? They want to buy a hole in the wall. They don't want to buy a drill, right? And, you know, you think about that applied to software, it's the exact same thing, right? And it's a matter of framing the problem. What is it that the customer wants? What is it that somebody wants our software to do, right? They want a hole in the wall, or they want a beverage delivery mechanism.
Yeah, I've worked for several companies where they come up with a solution, and then I've asked them, you know, what's our goal? How will we know that we've been successful if we deliver this? And they stare at me like a deer in the headlights. They have no idea how to know if the thing that they're asking for is successful. They had no purpose in designing it. They just came up with it and wanted us to make it.
The last book I wrote, I wrote the reviews I wanted to receive on the book before I wrote a chapter of the book. Here's what I want people to be able to say. This book helped me learn how to do this. This book covered this topic. And so I had, five or six different Amazon reviews, and, you know, each a paragraph long or something, but they were some of the things I wanted people to say. And I'm working on a new course right now and working with somebody on my team, and we're kind of writing some of the marketing material rather than starting with the content, because I want to be able to know what the promise is we're going to make to somebody in the marketing for that product. And then I can create the course that fulfills that promise. So
I really like that idea. Did you go like whole hog and come up with personas and everything?
I did. I had, for my book, I had three posters on my wall. They were three different personas. I don't remember them in detail. One I remember had read a book called Agile Project Management by Jim Highsmith, which is a great book, but it's really just about the project management side of things. And, the persona that had read that book, and I think one other book, now needed to go deeper, right? They really wanted to know how to take an agile team and make them a good agile team and overcome like four or five challenges. That was one of the personas. And then I wrote a review that I wanted that person to say on Amazon, including negative things, right? I included the negative things in there because those to me were things I decided I would not go into in the book. As an example, I was going to write, I didn't know how long it'd be, but it ended up being about 40 pages on scaling, which is pretty good for a book on Agile in general. And so I did want the person to say, you know, great introduction to scaling, but I need to get a little bit more detail on scaling, right? And, you know, that would be somebody writing a 200-page book, not a 40-page chapter. So I was, you know, honest with this stuff that I wasn't going to write 200 pages on scaling in a book that was going to cover 20 Agile topics.
So what about when these terms become weapons for the team? You know, maybe the business is bought in that, okay, yeah, we're going to do this Agile thing or this Scrum thing. But then it becomes, well, you know, for this 2-week sprint, you committed to delivering 40 points, regardless of the fact that we actually didn't properly break those stories down and get adequate requirements. You know, so we're going to need you to work the weekend on those, on delivering those points. You know, there's a danger where the points become more valuable than the proposed value that we're attempting to deliver.
Yeah, I think that's a huge problem. I think something's gone astray in particularly in the Scrum world, maybe Agile in general, but I see more of it with Scrum because I see more Scrum teams, but where too many teams, and sometimes it's the team's fault, turn Scrum into a check the boxes process, right? Did we finish the 9 user stories? And no, we did 8 of them, but they're amazing. Or, you know, we came up with a way that's going to rock the world. You know, the early days of Scrum, that attitude was not there. It was very much meant to be a way to find breakthrough innovations. You know, you put a team under, I don't want to make it sound the wrong way, but you put a team under a little bit of pressure, right? There's a little bit of pressure to get this thing done, and they find innovative solutions. And, you know, you don't want to give a team infinite time, that, you know, it'll never happen. And so it's this subtle, like, you know, you got to get it done. Back then it was always a month. So you got 4 weeks. And, it led to breakthrough thinking. And nobody ever back in the late 90s, even the early 2000s, produced a report that said you made 7 out of 8 backlog items or 7 out of 8 user stories. And that is just so fundamental now. And it's like, I totally see the point of people arguing against velocity these days because there's so many bad uses of it. And I end up talking to a lot of people. It's like, you know, you can ruin velocity. You can use it as the absolute best measure you've ever had of whether you're on track, or you can use it as one more thing to hit a team over the head with. And, you know, I'll offer to, you know, like, if you want me to give you 20 other ways to beat up a team, I'll do it, but don't ruin velocity, right? Well, I mean, do something like print out a memo and leave it in the printer about how you're looking to outsource the entire project, right? Let your developers find that, right? If you want to get creative, you can find out better ways to beat up a team than velocity. And so velocity, you know, misinterpreting commitment to mean guarantee, they just kind of ruin it for good teams.
Yeah. And that's, you know, one of the benefits of having a good retrospective and truly learning from the previous sprint and moving forward and improving is that we missed that story. We didn't deliver that story. We missed these points, whatever. Why can we adjust? Do you think we need to maybe commit to less in the future? Was there something that we missed and didn't understand the scope of something? I mean, there's all sorts of valuable information that can be gained from that if it's handled properly. If it's handled with, you miss the commitment, you're a bad boy, I think everyone loses at that point.
Oh, one guy took my class one time. This is years ago, but he took my class and he said, "Hey, Mike, you talked about commitment." And he said, "My boss took somebody else's class and that guy talked about commitment too." And he said, "What do you think of my boss's email that he sent the entire team?" And the boss's email basically said, "If you don't make your commitment, I will take corrective action up to and possibly including termination." It's incredible, right? And this boss ruined it, right? Now these teams have to feel like they have to commit to so much they don't get yelled at for not committing to enough, but not so much they're at any risk of missing. Right. And so it's no longer what's a reasonable expectation. It's, you know, how do we find that safe spot between getting yelled at today or getting yelled at in 2 weeks?
Yeah, I think that's a 5-point story, but I'm going to say 10. That way I meet my quota and the boss doesn't get too upset.
Yeah, I use the example a lot of a football quarterback. Right. And you don't want your football quarterback to throw 100% complete passes, right? And think about what would happen if you went to some quarterback and said, "I'm going to fire you if you don't throw every pass complete," right? You know, the guy's just never going to throw, right? Or he's going to throw 2-yard passes and hope. But it's not what you want, right? That is, you know, a quarterback who throws some incomplete passes should be considered extremely successful, right? I mean, you know, and they are, right? I mean, nobody expects quarterback 100%. And we shouldn't be expecting the same with teams. It's just not realistic. It just makes teams too conservative.
So in wrapping sort of things up a little bit, would you kind of speak to the listeners that we have that are sort of new or younger or just less mature and maybe are trying to advance themselves, trying to get into development, trying to get into Agile, understanding what this is? Maybe they're primarily still dealing with the sort of waterfall methodologies or in software development. Would you kind of give some like specific tips and pointers to them on sort of how they can kind of get themselves kickstarted and kind of advanced?
Yeah, one thing, if your organization's not ready to go to Agile, or you've got a manager that's resistant to it, I think that's fine. We don't have to have everybody just, you know, itching to do this. There is plenty of room to debate whether Agile's good or not. I mean, I'm totally open to that debate. The debate that I don't think exists in the world is whether iterative development is good, right? There is nobody out there that says software should be built in a big bang. Let me rephrase that. Nobody knows what they're talking about is saying that, right? The true waterfall model of do all the analysis before any design, all the design before any coding, all the coding before any testing, nobody advocates that. Go on Amazon and try to find the best book on waterfall. It doesn't exist, right? Nobody's written one. There is plenty of room to debate whether we should be using 3-month iterations or 2-week iterations, right? And, you know, I would not consider a 3-month iteration very agile. If your organization is not ready to go agile, that's fine. But start taking some of the agile ideas and use them in longer iterations, right? Nobody's going to debate that. And, or if they do, you can argue against them. I get it. Some business people will because they just don't understand that, you know, we can't build something perfect the first try. But go to, 3-month iterations, right? That's a start. And start bringing in some of the things that you like about Agile, the focus on testing, perhaps, or the communication, right? Add in some retrospectives. It's like, okay, you're only doing a retrospective every 3 months. Well, do that. And then, you know, get people to see that's a good thing and say, hey, let's not do them just at the end of every iteration. Let's do them at the last day of every month. Let's do February 28th. We'll do one, right? And so start bringing some of those things in. And if the organization is totally resistant, skip the vocabulary, right? I mean, you know, the vocabulary is, you know, who wants to have somebody in your office that you have to call master, right? I mean, you know, scrum master, right? It's like, it's just a bad term, right? Sprint. I mean, again, I love scrum, but I mean, you know, bad term. Sprint, right? Who wants to finish and be out of breath, right? So, you know, avoid some of the terms, right? Avoid anything that's overloaded like that, and just start bringing in the ideas. And that all fits with what I was describing about how this stuff all just has to eventually go away. It just has to be what we do. And, you know, we don't talk about it as this holy grail. You know, you have to be agile. It's like, no, you got to do great development. So
be iterative with the way that you bring in.
Absolutely, John. Yeah, be iterative, right? I mean, that is part of, you know, what I'll tell people. Like, I try to get people to adopt Agile, and yes, be iterative in how you adopt it. People struggle with, like, how long their iterations should be, and they'll have, you know, 3-week debates about how long their iterations are. Just start, right? Pick one, see how it goes, right? Literally randomly, just pick a length randomly and see how it goes.
Excellent. What other resources might you point people to? Just kind of looking into Agile. Obviously, you have the, you know, resources that you produce and courses that your company.
We have quite a bit on our website. We have our website is mountaingoatsoftware.com. The absolute best book on Scrum for somebody getting started with this is called Essential Scrum. It's by Ken Rubin. That's a wonderful book. The title's a bit of a misnomer. It goes way into more than essentials, but it does cover everything that you'd want to need to get started in that. So I would steer people towards that as kind of the best starting point. We have a simple website called scrumfoundations.com, and it's, I don't know, it's like an hour of videos. And if somebody's like 100% new, that would be a good starting point. We give that to our in-person attendees to watch, so that everybody kind of comes in with the same foundation. But I'd start with that as just a, you know, free hour of videos or hour or so, and then go on to Ken's book if you find Agile interesting at all.
Yeah, I absolutely love that book, by the way.
Oh, good.
There wasn't a single word in that book that I wasn't like, yes, yes, absolutely, yes.
Ken would be happy. He's a great guy. But when he starts a book, what he does is he spends about, I'm going to exaggerate, but it seems like it, he spends like 6 months creating a glossary of what every word is going to mean. And then he uses every word precisely that way. And I'm just like, I'm just going to spew out words. And so Ken's great. But yeah, he's very picky on the words. So he would love to know that every single word was perfectly used. So it's a wonderful book, Essential Scrum.
And how about people who, if they just want to follow you or, you know, what you're doing, do you have a Twitter handle you can plug or where can they follow you, find you?
I do. I think I'm Mike W. Cohn on Twitter. So Mike W. and then C-O-H-N. And I'm on Facebook and LinkedIn the same. I don't remember all of my handles on those things. I don't pay enough attention to what I got called after the first day when I got whatever name it was assigned me. But I mean, the biggest thing is just, you can find me on mountaingoatsoftware.com. And, you know, I put out a weekly tip. I try to keep a couple hundred words, just really short, one little tip helping people succeed with Agile. So that's kind of the easiest way to stay in touch with me is sign up for that little newsletter. I don't really bombard people. It's just like one short email a week.
All right. Thanks, Mike. Really appreciate you coming on the show.
Well, thank you, guys. Have a good day.
That was Mike Cohn. For over 20 years, Mike has been building high-performing software development teams and organizations through the use of Agile and Scrum. He's worked with startups and some of the largest organizations in the world.
If you like this episode, please like, rate, and review on iTunes.
Find show notes, blog posts, and more at sixfiguredev.com.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at sixfiguredev.
This has been another episode of the Six Figure Developer Podcast, helping others reach their potential. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I am John Ash.